sitting impassively on the bed, subservient, docile. My parents, with their move to New Zealand imminent, were suspicious of the mysterious bug I had apparently picked up in Thailand and which prevented me from visiting Millie. To discourage them from visiting, Jack had told them it was potentially contagious, but I could tell from their anxious phone calls that they were worried my interest in Millie had waned now that I was married. I only saw them once before they left, when they came to say a hurried goodbye, and it was then, during a quick tour of the house, that I finally saw the rest of the rooms on the first floor. I had to hand it to Jack. Not only had he made me tidy away all my belongings so that he could pass my bedroom off as one of the guest rooms, he had strewn my clothes around his bedroom to make it look as if I slept there too. I longed to tell my parents the truth, to beg them to help me. But with Jack's arm heavy on my shoulder, the courage to say anything at all never came. I still might have said something, if it hadn't been for Millie's room. As my parents exclaimed over the pale yellow walls, the beautiful furnishings, and the four-poster bed piled high with cushions, I couldn't believe that Jack would have gone to so much trouble if he really had evil intentions towards her. It gave me hope. Hope that, buried somewhere, deep down inside him, there remained a small pocket of decency. That he'd control me, but leave Millie free. The week after my parents left, Jack finally took me to see Millie. It was a long 5 weeks after our return from Thailand, and by that time, Millie's leg had mended, and we were able to take her out for lunch. But the Millie I found waiting for me was vastly different from the happy girl I'd left behind. My parents had mentioned that Millie had been difficult while we'd been away, and I'd put it down to her disappointment at not being our bridesmaid. I knew also that she resented I hadn't gone to see her as soon as we'd got back from our honeymoon, because during my phone calls to her, where Jack had stood breathing down my neck, she'd been practically monosyllabic. Although I quickly won her over with the souvenirs Jack had allowed me to buy for her at the airport, as well as a new Agatha Christie audiobook, she all but ignored him, and I could tell that he was furious, especially as Janice was present. I tried to pretend that Millie was upset because we hadn't brought Molly with us, but as she hadn't made a fuss when I'd told her we'd left her digging up bulbs in the garden, it hadn't rung true. When Jack told her, in an effort to rescue the situation, that he was taking us to a new hotel for lunch, she replied that she didn't want to go anywhere with him, and that she didn't want him to live with us either. Janice, in an attempt to defuse the situation, diplomatically took Millie off to fetch a coat, whereupon Jack lost no time in telling me that if she didn't change her attitude, he'd make sure I never saw Millie again. Searching again for something else to excuse Millie's behaviour, I told him that in view of what she'd said about him not living with us, she obviously hadn't realised that once we were married, he would be with me all the time, and resented having to share me with him. I didn't believe for a minute what I was saying. Millie understood very well that being married meant living together, and I knew I would have to get to the bottom of Millie's attitude towards Jack before he lost his patience and carried out his threat of the asylum. But with him always at my side, watching my every move and gesture, I couldn't see how I was going to be able to talk to her in private. My chance came at the hotel Jack took us to for lunch. At the end of the meal, Millie asked me to go with her to the toilet. Realising it was my chance to talk to her, I got to my feet, only for Millie to be told by Jack that she was perfectly capable of going on her own. But she insisted, her voice getting louder and louder, forcing Jack to give way. So he came with us. When he saw that the ladies' toilets was down a short corridor where he wouldn't be able to accompany us without it looking suspicious, he dragged me back and reminded me, in a whisper that sent a chill down my spine, that I wasn't to tell Millie, or anyone else for that matter, anything, adding that he would wait for us at the end of the corridor and warning that we weren't to take long. "Grace! Grace!" Millie cried as soon as we were on our own. Jack bad man, very bad man. He pushed me downstairs. I put my finger against her mouth, warning her to be quiet, looking around me fearfully. The fact that the cubicles were empty was the first piece of luck I'd had for a very long time. No, Millie, I whispered, terrified that Jack had come down the corridor anyway and was listening from outside the door. Jack wouldn't do that. He pushed me, Grace. At the wedding house, Jack pushed me hard like this. She bumped me with her shoulder. Jack hurt me. Broke leg. No, Millie, no, I hushed. Jack is a good man. No, not good, Millie was adamant. Jack bad man. Very bad man. You mustn't say that, Millie. You haven't told anybody, have you, Millie? You haven't told anybody what you've just told me. She shook her head vigorously. You say always tell Grace things first. But now I tell Janice that Jack bad man. No, Millie, you mustn't. You mustn't tell anybody. Why? Grace not believe me. My mind raced, wondering what I could tell her. By now I knew what Jack was capable of, and suddenly it made sense, especially when I remembered that he had never wanted her to be our bridesmaid. Look, Millie. I took her hands in mine, knowing that Jack would be suspicious if we were too long. Shall we play a game? A secret game for just you and me? Do you remember Rosie? I asked, referring to the imaginary friend she invented when she was younger to take the blame for her own wrongdoings. She nodded vigorously. Rosie do bad things, not Millie. Yes, I know, I said solemnly. She was very naughty. Millie looked so guilty that I couldn't help smiling. I not like Rosie. Rosie bad, like Jack. But it wasn't Jack who pushed you down the stairs. Was, she said stubbornly. No, it wasn't. It was somebody else. She looked at me suspiciously. Who? I cast desperately round for a name. George Clooney. Millie stared at me for a moment. George Clooney? Yes. You don't like George Clooney, do you? No, don't like George Clooney, she agreed. He was the one who pushed you down the stairs, not Jack. A frown furrowed her brow. Not Jack? No, not Jack. You like Jack, Millie. You like Jack very much. I gave her a little shake. It's very important that you like Jack. He didn't push you down the stairs. George Clooney did. Do you understand? You have to like Jack, Millie. For me. She looked at me closely. You scared? Yes, Millie, I'm scared. So please tell me that you like Jack. It's very important. I like Jack, she said obediently. Good, Millie. But don't like George Clooney. No, you don't. You don't like George Clooney at all. He bad. He pushed me downstairs. Yes, he did. But you don't have to tell people that. You mustn't tell people that George Clooney pushed you down the stairs. That's a secret like Rosie. But you must tell people that you like Jack. That's not a secret. And you must tell Jack that you like him. Do you understand?
I understand, she nodded. Must tell Jack like him.
Yes.
I tell him I not like George Clooney?
Yes, you can tell him that too. She leant in closer to me.
But Jack, George Clooney. George Clooney, Jack, she whispered.
Yes, Millie. Jack is George Clooney, but only we know that, I whispered back. Do you see what I mean? It's a secret. Our secret, like Rosie.
Jack bad man, Grace.
Yes, Jack bad man, but that's our secret too. You mustn't tell anyone.
I not live with him. I scared.
I know.
So what you do?
I'm not sure yet, but I'll find a solution.
Promise?
Promise. She looked closely at me.
Grace sad.
Yes, Grace sad.
Don't worry. Millie here. Millie help Grace.
Thank you, I said, hugging her. Remember, Millie, you like Jack.
I not forget.
And you mustn't say you don't want to live with him.
Won't. Good, Millie.
Outside, we found Jack waiting impatiently for us. Why were you so long? He asked, giving me a long look.
I have period, said Millie importantly. Need long time for period.
Shall we go for a walk before we go back?
Yes, I like walk.
Maybe we can find an ice cream along the way. Remembering what I told her, she beamed at him.
Thank you, Jack.
Well, she seems to have recovered some of her good humour, Jack remarked as Millie skipped along in front of us. When we were in the toilets, I explained that now that we're married, it's normal that you're always with me, and she's understood that she has to share me with you. As long as that was all you said.
Of course it was.
Janice was waiting when we dropped her off at school an hour later. You look as if you've had a nice time, Millie, she smiled.
Have,
Millie agreed. She turned to Jack.
I like you, Jack. You nice.
I'm glad you think so, he nodded, looking over at Janice.
But don't like George Cooney.
That's fine by me, he told her. I don't like him either. And Millie howled with laughter. Present. We're going to Esther and Rufus's tonight and to see Millie tomorrow. I know for certain that we're going because Janice took the liberty of phoning yesterday to check with Jack that we were. It seems she has a family lunch that she can't miss, and there's nobody to look after Millie if we don't go. But as we haven't been for 3 weeks, I can't help thinking it's an excuse. Privately, I think she's getting a little fed up of us not turning up to take Millie out. Something I'm surprised Jack isn't more careful about. At the expense of punishing me, he's risking Janice questioning our commitment to Millie. But as that can only be in our favour, I'm hardly going to point it out to him. Maybe it's because I know I'll be seeing Millie tomorrow that I feel less stressed than usual about going out tonight. Dinners at friends are the equivalent of walking through a minefield for me, as I'm always worried about doing or saying something Jack will use against me. I'm pleased that I didn't fall into the trap he set me by shading the words in Esther's book, although I'll have to be careful that I don't say anything to her that he could misconstrue. He took the book away with him when he brought me my breakfast this morning, and I laughed to think of him scouring the pages in vain for anything untoward, a word or two scored through with my nail, perhaps. It obviously annoyed him to find there was nothing, because he spent most of the day in the basement. Always a bad sign. And very boring for me. I prefer it when he moves around, as it amuses me to chart his movements as he goes from one room to the next, trying to work out what he's doing from the sounds that come to me from below. I know he's in the kitchen at the moment and that he's just made himself a cup of tea because a few minutes ago I heard the sound of the kettle being filled with water and the click when it switched itself off. I envy him. One of the many things I hate about being kept a prisoner is not being able to make myself a cup of tea whenever I want, and I miss my kettle and the regular supply of tea bags and milk I used to have. When I think about it now, Jack was a pretty generous jailer in the beginning. From the way the sun is beginning to dip in the sky, I guess that it's somewhere around 6 in the evening, and as we have to be at Esther's for 7, Jack should be coming up to let me into the bedroom next door, the one that used to be mine, so that I can get ready. Before long, I hear his footsteps on the stairs. A moment later, the key turns in the lock and the door swings open. When I see him standing there, I feel as dismayed as I always do at how normal he looks. Because surely there should be something. Pointed ears or a pair of horns to warn people of his evilness. He stands back to let me pass, and I go eagerly into the room next door, glad to have the chance to dress up, to wear something other than black, something other than slippers on my feet. I slide open the wardrobe door and wait for Jack to tell me what to wear. When he doesn't say anything, I know he is out to give me false hope by letting me believe I can wear what I want, only to tell me to take it off again as soon as I've put it on. Maybe because I managed to see through his ruse with the book, I decide to gamble and choose a dress that I don't want to wear at all, because it's black. I take my pyjamas off, uncomfortable though it is to have Jack looking on as I dress and undress. I can't do anything about it, as I lost my right to privacy long ago. "You're beginning to look a bit scrawny," Jack remarks as I put on my underwear. "Maybe you should bring me something to eat a little more often," I suggest. "Maybe I should," he agrees. By the time I've got into the dress and am doing the zip-up, I begin to think I've got it wrong. "Take it off," he says as I smooth it down. "Wear the red one." I feign disappointment as I take off the black dress, pleased that I've managed to outwit him, because the red is the one I would have chosen to wear. I slip it on, and maybe because of the colour, I feel more confident. I walk over to the dressing table, sit down in front of the mirror, and look at myself for the first time in 3 weeks. The first thing I notice is that my eyebrows need plucking. Much as I hate having to do such rituals in front of Jack, I take my tweezers from the drawer and start perfecting my eyebrows. I had to negotiate the right to wax my legs, pointing out that I couldn't look perfect if they were covered in hair, and, fortunately, he agreed to add a packet of wax strips to the minimal supply of toiletries he brings me each month. When I finished my eyebrows, I put on my makeup and, in honour of the dress, choose a brighter lipstick than usual. I stand up, walk over to the wardrobe and look through the shoe boxes, looking for my red and black high-heeled shoes. I slip them on my feet, take the matching bag off the shelf, and hand it to him. He opens it and looks inside, checking that sometime over the past 3 weeks I haven't managed to conjure up pen and paper out of thin air and transport a note through solid walls and into the bag. Passing it back to me, he looks me up and down and nods approvingly, which, ironically, I know is more than some women get from their husbands. We go downstairs, and in the hall, he takes my coat from the cupboard and holds it open while I slip my arms into it. In the drive outside, he holds the car door open for me and waits until I'm in. As he closes it behind me, I can't help thinking it's a shame he's such a sadistic bastard because he has wonderful manners. We arrive at Esther and Rufus's house, and, along with a huge bouquet of flowers and a bottle of champagne, Jack hands Esther back her book, which I presume he's returned to its original state. She asks me what I thought of it, and I tell her what I told Jack, that it took me a while to get through it because it wasn't the sort of book I would normally read. She seems overly disappointed, which makes me wonder if it was her who highlighted the words after all, and, hiding my panic, I look at her anxiously. But there's nothing on her face to suggest I might have missed an opportunity, and my heartbeat slows back down. We go through to where Diane and Adam are waiting, Jack's arm around my waist. I don't know if it's because of all the little courtesies he's accorded me, or because I managed to wear the dress that I wanted, but by the time we've finished our drinks and are heading for the table, I'm beginning to feel as if I'm a normal woman on a normal night out, instead of a prisoner out with her jailer. Or maybe it's just that I've had too much champagne to drink. As we wind our way through the delicious dinner that Esther has cooked for us, I'm aware of Jack watching me from across the table, as I eat too much and talk a lot more than I usually do. "You look pensive, Jack," Esther remarks. "I was just thinking how much I'm looking forward to Millie coming to live with us. he says in what only I recognise as a call to order. "Can't be long now," she says. 75 days, Jack sighs happily. "Did you know that, Grace? Only another 75 days until Millie moves into her lovely red bedroom and becomes part of our family." I'd been about to take a sip of wine, but my heart plummets so fast that the glass comes to an abrupt stop in midair and a little slops over the side. "No, I didn't know," I say, wondering how I could have sat there so complacently when time is running out, wondering how I could have forgotten, even for 1 minute, the desperate situation that I'm in. 75 days! How could there be so little time left? More importantly, how am I ever going to be able to think of a way of escaping from Jack when I haven't been able to in the 375 days that must have passed since we came back from our honeymoon? Back then, even after the horror I'd been through and the ones that had faced me when we arrived at the house, I had never doubted that I would be able to escape before Millie came to live with us. Even when each attempt I had made failed, there had always been a next time. But I hadn't tried for more than 6 months now. "Carry on, Grace," says Jack, nodding at my glass of wine and smiling at me. I stare back at him numbly, and he raises his glass. "Let's drink to Millie coming to live with us." He looks around the table. "In fact, why don't we all drink to Millie?"
"Good idea," Adam says, raising his glass.
"To Millie."
"To Millie," everyone chimes as I try to fight the panic rising inside of me. Aware of Esther looking at me curiously, I raise my glass quickly, hoping she won't notice my shaking hand.
"While we're in a celebratory mood," Adam says, "perhaps you'd all care to raise your glasses again." Everybody looks at him in interest. "Diane is expecting a baby. A brother or sister for Emily and Jasper."
"What wonderful news," says Esther, as congratulations fly around the table. "Don't you think so, Grace?" To my horror, I burst into tears. In the shocked silence that follows, the thought of the punishment that Jack is going to exact from me for my lack of self-control makes me cry even more. I try frantically to stem the tears, but it's impossible, and horribly embarrassed, I get to my feet, aware of Diane at my side, trying to comfort me. But it is Jack who takes me in his arms, because how can he do otherwise? And holds me close, cradling my head against his shoulder, murmuring soothing words of comfort, and I cry even harder, thinking of how it could have been, of how I had thought it would be. For the first time, I want to give up, to die, because suddenly everything is too much and there is no solution in sight.
"I can't go on like this,"
I sob to Jack, not caring that everyone is listening.
"I know," he soothes. "I know."
It's as if he's acknowledging that he's gone too far, and for a split second, I actually believe that everything is going to be all right.
"I think we should tell them, don't you?"
He raises his head.
"Grace had a miscarriage last week," he announces, "and I'm afraid it wasn't the first."
There's a collective gasp and a few seconds of appalled silence before everyone starts talking at once in subdued voices, commiserating with us. Although I know that their kind words of sympathy and understanding relate to a miscarriage I've never had, I manage to derive enough comfort from them to be able to pull myself together.
"I'm sorry,"
I mumble to Jack, hoping to dilute the anger I know I'll have to face later.
"Don't be silly," says Diane, patting my shoulder.
"But I wish you'd told us. I feel awful about Adam announcing my pregnancy like that."
"I can't go on any longer,"
I say, still speaking to Jack.
"You'd find it much simpler if you just accept everything," he says.
"Can't we just leave Millie out of it?" I ask desperately.
"I'm afraid not," he says solemnly.
"Millie doesn't have to know, does she?" asks Esther, puzzled. Well, there's no point upsetting her, Diane frowns. Jack turns to them. You're right, of course. It would be foolish to tell Millie about Grace's miscarriage. Now, I think I should take Grace home. I hope you'll forgive me for breaking up the party, Esther.
I'm fine, I say quickly, not wanting to leave the safety of Esther and Rufus's house, because I know what will be waiting for me once I get home.
I move out of Jack's arms, appalled that I could have taken comfort there for so long.
Really, I'm fine now and I'd like to stay.
Good, I'm glad. Please, Grace, sit back down. The shame in Esther's eyes tells me that her remark, the one that had prompted my tears, had been barbed, and that she feels guilty for having laboured the point that Diane was pregnant.
I'm sorry, she says quietly as I take up my place again, about your miscarriage.
It's all right, I say. Please, let's just forget it. As I drink the coffee that Esther has served, I work harder than I've ever worked before, horribly conscious of how stupid I was to let my guard down. Aware that I need to redeem myself if I want to see Millie tomorrow. I look lovingly at Jack and explain to everyone around the table that the reason I broke down was because I feel dreadful that, for the moment, I seem unable to give Jack the thing he wants most in the world, a baby. When we finally stand up to leave, I know that everyone admires my speedy and charming recovery, and I sense that Esther likes me a lot more than she did before, which can only be a good thing. Even if it's only because of my imperfect womb. Reality hits me once I'm sitting in the car on the way home. Jack's grim silence tells me that however much ground I've made up in relation to the others, he's still going to make me pay for my stupidity. The thought of not going to see Millie is more than I can bear, and as silent tears spring from my eyes, I'm shocked at how weak I've become. We arrive at the house. Jack unlocks the front door, and we go into the hall. You know, I've never questioned who I am, he says thoughtfully as he helps me off with my coat. But tonight, for a split second, when I was holding you in my arms, when everybody was commiserating with us about your miscarriage, I had a taste of what it was like to be normal.
You could be, I tell him. You could be if you really wanted to be. You could get help, Jack. I know you could.
He grins at my outburst. Trouble is, I don't want help. I like who I am. I like it very much indeed. And I'll like it even better in 75 days' time, when Millie comes to live with us. It's a shame we won't be going to see her tomorrow. I'm almost beginning to miss her.
Please, Jack, I beg.
Well, I certainly can't let you off for your appalling lack of restraint tonight, so if you want to see Millie tomorrow, you know what you have to do.
You couldn't stand that I didn't fall into your pathetic trap, could you?
I say, realising that he had set out to upset me during dinner by mentioning Millie coming to live with us.
Pathetic trap? Yes, that's right, pathetic. Couldn't you come up with anything better than shading words in a book?
You really are becoming too clever for your own good, he snaps. Whichever way I look at it, you need to be punished.
I shake my head pitifully. No, I can't. I've had enough, I mean it, Jack. I've had enough.
But I haven't, he says. I haven't had nearly enough. In fact, it hasn't even begun for me. That's the trouble, you see. The nearer I get to having what I've been waiting for so long, the more I crave it. It's got to the point where I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of waiting for Millie to move in with us.
Why don't we go back to Thailand? I say desperately, terrified he'll suggest Millie moves in with us sooner than planned. It will do you good. We haven't been since January.
I can't. I have the Tomasin case coming up.
But you won't be able to go once Millie comes to live with us, I point out, eager to consolidate my position, needing to keep Millie safe at school for as long as possible.
He gives me an amused glance. Trust me, once Millie comes to live with us, I won't want to. Now, get moving.
I start shaking so much that I have difficulty walking. I make my way to the stairs and put my foot on the bottom step.
You're going the wrong way, he says. Unless you don't want to see Millie tomorrow, of course.
He pauses a moment to make it sound as if he's giving me a choice.
So, what's it to be, Grace?
His voice is high with excitement.
A disappointed Millie? Or the basement?
Past. After what Millie had told me about Jack pushing her down the stairs, the pressure to get away from him intensified. Even though I'd made her promise not to tell anyone, I couldn't be sure that she wouldn't suddenly blurt it out to Janice, or even accuse Jack to his face. I don't think it had occurred to him that she might have realised her fall was more than an accident. It was easy to underestimate Millie, and presume that the way she spoke was a reflection of the way her mind worked, but she was a lot cleverer than people gave her credit for. I had no idea what Jack would do if he discovered that she knew very well what had happened that day. I supposed he would dismiss her accusations as quickly as he had dismissed mine, and suggest that she was jealous because he and I were now together, and was trying to break us up by making false accusations against him. The only thing that kept me going through that black time was Millie. She seemed so at ease with Jack that I thought she'd forgotten he'd pushed her down the stairs, or at least had come to terms with it. But whenever I told myself it was for the best, she would trot out what was fast becoming her mantra. I like you, Jack, but don't like George Cooney. As if she knew what I was thinking, and wanted to let me know that she was keeping her side of the bargain. As such, the pressure to keep my side of it grew, and I began to plan my next move. After what had happened when I'd tried to get the doctor to help me, I decided that next time, the more people who were around, the better it would be. So when I felt ready to try again, I pleaded with Jack to take me shopping with him, hoping that during the course of the trip I'd be able to get help from a shop assistant or member of the public. As I got out of the car, I thought my prayers had been answered when I saw a policeman standing only yards away from me. Even the way Jack held on to me tightly when I tried to break free lent weight to the fact that I was being kept prisoner, and when the policeman came hurrying over in response to my cries for help, I honestly thought my ordeal was over, until his concerned words, "Is everything all right, Mr. Angel?" told me otherwise. My behaviour from that point on confirmed what Jack had thought to tell the local constabulary some time before, namely that his wife had a history of mental problems and was prone to causing disturbances in public places, often by accusing him of keeping her prisoner. As Jack held my flailing limbs in a vice-like grip, he suggested to the policeman, in full hearing of the large crowd that had gathered, that he come and see the house that I called a prison. As the crowd looked on, whispering about mental illness and throwing Jack looks of solidarity, a police car arrived, and while I sat in the back with a policewoman who tried to still my tears of despair with soothing words, the policeman asked Jack about the work he did on behalf of battered women. Afterwards, once it was all over, and I was back in the room I had thought never to see again, the fact that he had so readily agreed for me to accompany him on the shopping trip confirmed what I had already worked out in Thailand, which was that he derived enormous pleasure from allowing me to think I had won, then snatching my victory away from me. He enjoyed preparing the ground for my downfall, rejoiced in his role as my loving but harassed husband, delighted in my crushing disappointment, and, when it was all over, took pleasure in punishing me. Not only that, his ability to predict what I was going to do meant that I was doomed to failure from the start. It was another 3 weeks before I saw Millie again, and Jack's explanation, that I had been too busy with friends to visit, hurt and confused her, especially as I couldn't tell her otherwise, with Jack constantly at her sides.
Determined not to let her down again, I began to toe the line so that I could see her regularly. But rather than please Jack, my subservience seemed to annoy him. I thought I'd got him wrong, however, when he told me that, because of my good behaviour, he was going to allow me to paint again. Suspicious of his intentions, I hid my delight from him and gave him a list of what I needed half-heartedly, not daring to believe he would actually bring me what I was asking for. The next day, however, he duly arrived with pastels and oils in a variety of colours, as well as my easel and a new canvas. "There's only one stipulation," he said, as I rejoiced over them like old friends. "I get to choose the subject matter."
"What do you mean?"
I frowned. "You paint what I want you to paint. Nothing more, nothing less." I looked at him warily, trying to weigh him up, wondering if it was another of his games. "It depends what you want me to paint," I said. "A portrait."
"A portrait?"
"Yes. You painted some before, haven't you?"
"A few."
"Good. So, I'd like you to paint a portrait."
"Of you?"
"Yes or no, Grace?" All my instincts told me to refuse, but I was desperate to paint again, desperate to have something to fill my days besides reading. Although the thought of painting Jack revolted me, I told myself he was hardly going to stand and pose for me hour after hour. At least, I hoped not. "Only if I can work from a photograph," I said, relieved to have found a solution.
"Done." He fished in his pocket. "Would you like to start now?"
"Why not?" I shrugged. He drew out a photograph and held it in front of my face.
"She was one of my clients. Don't you think she's beautiful?"
With a cry of alarm, I backed away from him, from it, but he followed me relentlessly, grinning inanely.
"Come on, Grace, don't be shy. Take a good look. After all, you're going to be seeing a lot of her over the next couple of weeks."
"Never," I spat. "I'll never paint her."
"Of course you will. You agreed, remember? And you know what happens if you go back on your word?"
I stared at him.
"That's right. Millie. You do want to see her, don't you?"
"Not if this is the price I have to pay," I said, my voice tight.
"I'm sorry. I should have said. You do want to see her again, don't you? I'm sure you don't want Millie to be left to rot in some asylum, do you?"
"You'd better not lay a finger on her," I yelled.
"Then you had better get painting. If you destroy this photograph, or deface it in any way, Millie will pay. If you don't reproduce it on canvas, or pretend that you're unable to, Millie will pay. I will check daily to see how you're progressing, and if I decide you are working too slowly, Millie will pay. And when you've finished, you will paint another, and another, and another, until I decide I have enough."
"Enough for what?" I sobbed,
knowing I was beaten. "I'll show you one day. I promise, Grace. I'll show you one day."
I cried and cried over that first painting. To have to look at a bruised and bloodied face hour after hour, day after day. To have to examine a broken nose, a cut lip, a black eye in minute detail and reproduce it on canvas was more than I could stomach, and I was often violently sick. I knew that if I was to keep hold of my sanity, I had to find a way of dealing with the trauma of painting something so grotesque, and I found that by giving the women in subsequent paintings names and looking beyond the damage that had been done to them, imagining them as they were before, I was able to cope better. It also helped that Jack had never lost a case, as it meant that the women in the photographs, all ex-clients of his, had managed to get away from their abusive partners, and it made me all the more determined to get away from him. If they could do it, so could I. We must have been about 4 months into our marriage when Jack decided that we'd spent enough time wrapped up in each other and that if people weren't to become suspicious, we would have to begin socialising as we had before. One of the first dinners we went to was at Moira and Giles's, but as they were primarily Jack's friends, I behaved exactly as he told me and played the loving wife. It made me sick to the stomach to do so, but I realised that if he didn't start trusting me, I'd be confined to my room indefinitely, and my chances of escaping would be drastically reduced. I knew I'd done the right thing when, not long after, he told me that we'd be dining with colleagues of his. The rush of adrenaline I felt on hearing that they were colleagues and not friends was enough to convince me that it would be the perfect opportunity to get away from him, as they were more likely to believe my story than friends who had already had the wool pulled over their eyes by Jack. And, with a bit of luck, Jack's success in the firm might mean there was somebody just waiting for the opportunity to stab him in the back. I knew I would have to be ingenious. Jack had already drummed into me how I was to act when other people were present. No going off on my own, not even to the toilet. No following anybody into another room, even if it was only to carry plates through. No having a private conversation with anybody. No looking anything but wonderfully happy and content. It took me a while to work out what to do. Rather than try to get help in front of Jack, who was so very good at dismissing my accusations, I decided it would be better to get a letter to someone, because there was less chance of me being dismissed as a hysterical madwoman if I put everything in writing. Indeed, in view of Jack's threats, it seemed the safest way forward. But getting my hands on even a small piece of paper proved impossible. I couldn't ask Jack outright because he would have been immediately suspicious, and not only would he have refused, he would have watched me like a hawk from then on. The idea of cutting relevant words out of the books he had thoughtfully supplied me with came to me in the middle of the night. Using a pair of small nail scissors from my toilet bag, I cut out, "Please help me. I am being held captive. Get police." I looked for a way of putting them in some kind of order. In the end, I put one on top of the other, starting with "please" and finishing with "police." They made such a tiny pile that the possibility of them being mistaken for just a screw of paper and being thrown away made me decide to secure them with one of my hair grips, which I had in my makeup bag. Surely, I reasoned, anyone who found a hair grip holding a bundle of little pieces of paper together would be curious enough to look at them. After a lot of thought, because I couldn't afford to have it opened in Jack's presence, I decided to leave my cry for help somewhere on the table once dinner was over, so it could be found after we'd left. I had no idea where we were having dinner, but I prayed it would be in someone's house and not in a restaurant, where the danger of the clip being scooped up in the tablecloth, along with other debris, was higher. In the event, my careful planning came to nothing. I had been so concerned as to where I should leave my precious bundle of words that I forgot I had to get it past Jack first. I wasn't overly worried until he came to fetch me, and after watching me for a moment, as I slipped on my shoes and picked up my bag, asked why I was so nervous. Although I pretended it was because I would be meeting his colleagues, he didn't believe me, especially as I had already met most of them at our wedding. He searched my clothes, getting me to turn out my pockets, and then demanded that I give him my bag. His anger, when he found the hair clip, was predictable, his punishment exactly as he had promised. He moved me into the box room, which he had stripped of every comfort, and began to starve me. Present. Waking in the basement, my mind instantly craves sunlight to anchor my internal clock, or something to make me feel I haven't finally lost my mind. I can't hear Jack, but I sense he's near, listening. Suddenly the door swings open. "You're going to have to move quicker than that if we're going to be in time to take Millie for lunch," he remarks as I slowly get to my feet. I know I should feel pleased that we're going, but the truth is, seeing Millie gets harder with each visit we make. Ever since she told me that Jack had pushed her down the stairs, she's been waiting for me to do something about it. I'm beginning to dread the day she'll actually manage to persuade Jack to take us to the hotel, because I don't want to have to tell her I still haven't found a solution. Back then, it never occurred to me that I would still be a prisoner a year on. I had known that it would be difficult to get away from him, but not that it would be impossible. And now there is so little time left. 74 days. The thought of Jack counting down the days until Millie comes to live with us, like a child waiting impatiently for Christmas, makes me feel sick. As usual, Millie and Janice are waiting on the bench for us. We chat for a while. Janice asks us if we enjoyed the wedding the previous weekend and our visit to friends the weekend before that, and Jack leaves it to me to invent that the wedding was in Devon, and very lovely, and that we enjoyed the Peak District, where our friends live, very much. Jack, ever charming, tells Janice that she's a treasure for allowing us to take advantage of the short time we have left together before Millie comes to live with us, and Janice replies that she doesn't mind at all, that she adores Millie, and is happy to step in for us whenever we need her to. She adds that she's going to miss her when she leaves, and reiterates her promise to come and visit us often, which Jack will make sure that she never does. We talk about how Millie has been, and Janice tells us that thanks to the sleeping pills the doctor prescribed, she's getting a good night's sleep, which means that she's back to her normal self during the day. "I'm sorry," she says apologetically, looking at her watch. "I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave you. My mother will kill me if I'm late for lunch." "We need to get going too," Jack says.
"Can we go to hotel today, please?" Millie asks eagerly.
Jack opens his mouth, but before he can tell us that he's taking us somewhere else, Janice intervenes. "Millie has been telling me all about the hotel and how much she likes it there, and she's promised to tell us about it in class on Monday, haven't you, Millie?" Millie nods enthusiastically. "She's already told us about the restaurant by the lake and the one that serves the pancakes, so we're looking forward to hearing about this one. And Mrs. Goodrich is thinking of taking the staff to the hotel for the end-of-year school dinner," she adds, "so she's commissioned Millie to write a report on it."
"Need to go to hotel for Mrs. Goodrich," Millie confirms.
"Then the hotel it is," says Jack, hiding his annoyance by smiling indulgently at her. Millie chats away happily during lunch, and when we've finished, she says she needs to go to the toilet.
"Go on then," says Jack.
She stands up.
"Grace, come with me."
"There's no need for Grace to go with you," Jack tells her firmly. "You're perfectly able to go by yourself."
"I have period,"
Millie announces loudly.
"Need Grace."
"Very well," says Jack, hiding his distaste. He pushes his chair back.
"I'll come too."
"Jack not allowed in ladies' toilet,"
Millie says belligerently. "I meant that I'll come as far as the toilets with you." He leaves us at the end of the corridor, warning us not to be too long. There are two ladies at the sinks, chatting away happily as they wash their hands, and Millie hops from foot to foot, impatient for them to leave. I rack my brains for something to tell her, something that will make her think I have a solution in mind, and marvel at the way she contrived to get Jack to bring us here by drawing Janice and Mrs. Goodrich into the equation. "That was clever of you, Millie," I tell her as soon as the door closes behind the women.
"Need to talk," she hisses.
"What is it?"
"Millie, have something for Grace," she whispers.
She slips her hand into her pocket and draws out a tissue.
"Secret,"
she says, handing it to me. Puzzled, I unfold the tissue, expecting to find a bead or a flower, and find myself looking at a handful of small white pills.
"What are these?" I frown.
"For sleep. I not take them."
"Why not?"
"Don't need them,"
she says, scowling. "But they're to help you to sleep better," I explain patiently.
"I sleep fine."
Yes, you do now because of the pills, I insist. Before you didn't, remember?
She shakes her head.
I pretend.
Pretend?
Yes, I pretend can't sleep.
I look at her, perplexed.
Why?
She closes my hand over the tissue.
For you, Grace.
Well, it's very kind of you, Millie, but I don't need them.
Yes, Grace need them. For George Clooney.
George Clooney?
Yes, George Clooney bad man. George Clooney push me downstairs. George Clooney make Grace sad. He bad man, very bad man.
Now it's my turn to shake my head. I'm afraid I don't understand.
Yes, you understand.
Millie is adamant.
It's simple, Grace. We kill George Clooney.
Past. The following month, we went back to Thailand, but I didn't dare try to escape again. I knew that if I did, Jack was capable of arranging for me to die while we were there. We went to the same hotel and had the same room, and were greeted by the same manager. Only Kiko was missing. I spent my days as I had spent them before, locked on the balcony or kept in the room, only being allowed out for photographs. My experience the second time round was made even worse by the knowledge that when Jack wasn't with me, he was exhilarating in someone else's fear. I didn't know how he got his kicks, but I presumed it was by doing something he couldn't do in England, and remembering the story he had told me about his mother, I wondered if he came to Thailand to beat up women. It seemed inconceivable that he would be able to get away with it, but once he told me that in Thailand, as long as you had money, you could buy anything, even fear. Maybe that was why, a week after we got back, I smashed him over the head with a bottle of wine in the kitchen, half an hour before Diane and Adam were due to arrive for dinner, hoping to stun him long enough to escape. But I didn't hit him hard enough, and, incandescent with rage, he controlled himself long enough to phone and cancel our guests, pleading a sudden migraine on my part. As he put the phone down and turned to me, I was afraid only for Millie, because there was nothing left he could deprive me of. Even when he told me that he was going to show me Millie's room, I still wasn't afraid for myself because all I presumed was that he had stripped it of its beautiful furnishings, as he had done mine. As he pushed me into the hall, my arms twisted painfully behind my back, I felt desperately sad for Millie because it was the room she had always dreamt of having. But instead of taking me up to the first floor, he opened the door that led down to the basement. I fought like mad not to go down the stairs, but I was no match for Jack, his already powerful strength inflamed by fury. Even then, I had no idea what was waiting for me. It was only when he dragged me past the utility room where he had kept Molly, through what seemed to be a storeroom, and came to a stop in front of a steel door cleverly hidden behind a stack of shelves, that I began to feel real fear. It wasn't some sort of torture chamber, as I'd first feared, because there were no instruments of torture as such. Devoid of furniture, the whole of the room, including the floor and ceilings, had been painted blood red. It was terrible, chilling, but it wasn't the only thing that caused me to cry out in distress.
"Take a good look," he snarled. "I hope Millie will appreciate it as much as I do, because this is the room where she's going to stay, not the pretty yellow bedroom upstairs."
He shook me hard.
"Look at it and tell me how scared you think she's going to be."
I could feel my eyes rolling in my head as I tried to look anywhere but at the walls, where the portraits he had forced me to paint for him hung.
"Do you think Millie is going to like the paintings you've done specially for her? Which one do you think will be her favourite? This one?
His hand on the back of my head, he pushed my face hard up against one of the portraits.
Or this one.
He dragged me over to one of the other walls. Such beautiful handiwork, don't you think? Moaning, I screwed my eyes shut tight.
I hadn't intended to show you this room just yet, he went on. But now you can try it for size. You really shouldn't have hit me with that bottle.
After giving me a final shove, he went out of the room, leaving the door to slam shut behind him. I scrambled to my feet and ran to the door. When I saw that there was no handle, I began hammering on it with my fists, screaming at him to let me out.
Scream all you like, his voice came through the door. You don't know how much it excites me.
Unable to control my fear, that he would never let me out, that he would leave me to die there, I became hysterical. Within seconds, I found I couldn't breathe, and as I began to hyperventilate, the pain in my chest brought me to my knees. Realizing that I was having some sort of panic attack, I fought to regain control of my breathing. But the sound of Jack laughing excitedly from the other side of the room only increased my distress. Tears streamed from my eyes, and unable to catch my breath, I honestly believed I was going to die. The thought that I would be leaving Millie at Jack's mercy was truly terrible, and as a picture of her wearing her yellow hat and scarf came into my mind, I clung on to it, wanting it to be the last thing I remembered. It was a while before I noticed that the pain in my chest had eased, making it possible for me to draw in deeper breaths. I didn't dare move in case I started everything off again. Instead, I stayed as I was, my head on my knees, and concentrated on my breathing. The relief that I was still alive, that I could still save Millie, gave me the strength to lift my head and look for another way out of the room. But there wasn't even a small window. I began searching the walls, running my hands over them and moving the paintings aside, hoping to find some sort of switch that would open the door.
You're wasting your time, Jack's voice drawled, making me jump. It can't be opened from the inside.
Just knowing he was on the other side of the door made me start shaking again.
How do you like the room? He went on. I hope you're enjoying yourself in there as much as I am listening to you out here. I can't wait to hear what Millie thinks of it. Hopefully she'll be even more vocal than you.
Suddenly exhausted, I lay down on the floor and curled myself into a ball, wedging my fingers in my ears so that I wouldn't have to listen to him. I prayed for sleep to take me, but the room remained brightly lit, making it impossible. As I lay there, I tried not to consider the possibility that he would never let me out of the hell he had created for Millie. And when I remembered how I had truly believed on the strength of a beautiful yellow bedroom, that somewhere deep inside him lay a tiny shred of decency, I wept at my stupidity.